Well, here we are. It's another week of Life in the Peloton, and I've got a great episode coming up. It's a bit of a mailbag, but it's a semi-slash talking to a good friend of mine, Tom Southam. Welcome, Lionel. Great to talk to you again on Life in the Peloton. How are you, mate?
I'm good, thanks, Mitch. Yeah, I've just finished our Giro over on the Cycling Podcast. Myself, Richard Moore and Daniel Freeb produced 23 podcasts in 23 days. Pretty much standard Grand Tour coverage for us. But without a race going on, we had to be a little bit creative and tell some stories from the Giro's past, the distant past, and also the most recent past. And in the midst of that, Mitch, your episode fitted absolutely perfectly with everything we were putting out, because if your listeners haven't already caught up on your last episode of Life in the Peloton, I would urge them to go back and listen to the last one. It told the story of the team time trial, the build up to the team time trial in Belfast in 2014 for the Orica Green Edge team, which you, of course, Mitch, were part of. And you won the team time trial that day. And the episode, I mean, the feedback we've had from the listeners who have tuned into it has been absolutely amazing. I've been so pleased to see that people loved the way that you spoke to your ex-teammates, and the way that our producer Will Jones put the episode together. It's a real ensemble piece that tells the story of a memorable weekend for the team.
Yeah, I tell you what, I was a driving force during that team's time trial, and we get to hear about all the riders, and it's just a great thing. One thing I noticed with that time trial is, well, that whole Giro, every time I see those guys, and for the years after, that was the one Giro or the one race that we always spoke about. And that's why it just came to me straight up. I need to get the guys to talk about this Giro. It's the one memory that we always talk about. The team time trial, but that whole race. So much happened. So if you haven't heard it, you've got to go back and listen to this. This is an awesome podcast. I loved recording it. You know, there was about 6 or 8 hours of recording in it. And Will was able to punch it down to about hours of worth of podcasts. So he did an amazing job. I hope you had a good time listening through all the extra stuff, because it was fantastic. But this week, we've gone back a step and we've gone, you know what? What do you guys want to hear about? And we've sent out the mailbag. You guys have sent the questions in. I've spoken to a good friend of mine who's now my director, Tom Southam. He's the director at EF Education First. Sit back and enjoy this one. Your questions are out there. We've answered them, or we've tried our best to answer them. So really enjoy this one, guys. All right, here we go. We've got a special podcast today. I'm talking to ex-teammate, longtime friend, now my director, still friend, Tom Southam. Welcome to the podcast, mate.
Thanks, man. Pleasure to be here.
Well, if anyone doesn't know who Tom is, I've done a little bit of background on him, because there's a little bit of stuff I actually didn't know about Tom. You know, look, he was a pro back in 2003. He started his career in Italy with Moro Vita, then moved on to South African team. Was it South African then?
The first year was registered in South Africa. The second year was registered in the UK, but the sponsor was always South African.
We're talking about Barlow World now, and Froome was on the team then too, wasn't he?
He came after me, so.
Yeah, right.
I think they made a good change there.
But it was a great team. Tom then decided to pause cycling and just went back to Australia, and then that's when we met. Drapac, yep. Porsche development team, and he gave us a bit of experience. I always remember our first meeting there, and I was just like, who the hell is this guy? Like, I was feeling like I was a bit of top-notch there, and I was like, I just didn't know who you were. I didn't really know the pro overseas pro scene apart from, you know, the cream of the crop. And I remember you came on, and you just had this really cool sort of laid-back attitude, and I was like, this guy's no good. And then all of a sudden, we got into racing. I was like, oh, right. This guy knows his stuff, you know. So that's where Tom came across to Drapac. And then actually you stopped Drapac then and then went back to the UK, because you're from the UK, Cornwall?
Yep, Penzance, down in Cornwall, all the way down the end.
And then went back to the UK and started racing with, and this was a curveball for me, Team Halfords Bike Hut. Tell me about that.
It was a women's team, actually, I think, principally. I was like, Halfords is like, it's a big chain of bike stores in the UK and car parts. So yeah, I guess it's kind of like Bunnings for bikes in the UK. And they put some money into a team. They wanted to sponsor Nicole Cook, who they sponsored. And then they also took on two men. One was myself and one was Rob Hales, who won the National Road Race Championships that year. And it was actually like one of my favorite years on the bike because I'd been in Europe and, you know, racing in Italy for years and France before that and Holland before that. And Rob had been away and he'd done the track thing and he'd been at Cofidis for a few years. We both came to this sort of odd setup where, you know, we had the bikes were off the shop floor from like your bargain sort of basement ride to work bikes. So they were like cost £1,000 or something for these bikes we had. I mean, they were basic. We just both had this great year where we had this attitude of like, let's just go and race our bikes. You know, we took ourselves to Kermesses in Belgium. You know, we did the racing in the UK and we just like, I think we went to Belgium 1 week for Kermesses and we did like four or five races and we were never like, we're either first or second one of us, like the whole time. Just that like really good vibe when you just, it's just working, you know? And at the same moment, we were up till 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, having like late dinners and plenty of wine. And like Rob likes his good food and drinks. And, you know, it was a great year. It was a fun year. And then Rob obviously ended up winning the Nationals. We were both in the break that year. And that was a pretty special day.
He won the Nationals when he was riding for Bike Hut.
Yep, on the £1,000 bike, yeah. It was a five-man break in the end, two of us in it, and I rode, and then he finished it off.
You're kidding me. I did not know that. That is amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
So then I wanted to talk about your career, so to set up who you really are. On from there, you went to Rafa Condor, and that was the first year of Rafa, wasn't it? Rafa Condor, the team, in 2009, and you were there for a couple of years. Was that team around before that?
It was, I think the team started in, it started as a Conti team, I think, in 2008. But so that team was run by John Herity, who looked after me from basically 18 to 23 on the World Class Performance Programme, which is what you'd call the academy now. And I mean, that was always a natural choice for me to go and race for John. I also met Simon Mottram from Rafa in way back in 2005. I went to visit them in London when they had a tiny little sort of one room office in London. They were starting up this brand that was going to be a bit different. And like I went in and they had some like amazing imagery of Fausto Coppi and these beautiful, I think they just had a jersey at the time, a jersey and a pair of gloves or some arm warmers or something. And so there was a kind of connection there. And then, after the Halfords year, that was my sort of natural fit for me. I think I spent 3 years there as a rider. It was what I was looking for because I think like when I went to Europe and when I was in bigger teams in Europe, like I really enjoy being part of a team where people get on and you kind of make things better by the good atmosphere around you. And in Barlow World, I had none of that in the second year. I really, I remember going to races and sharing rooms with guys who I didn't know, I got on a plane and landed in Portugal or wherever and went to a hotel room and sat next to this guy who had done the same thing and I had nothing in common. There was no common ground there. So going to Rafa Condor was basically just like going and getting to race your bike and being with some really good mates, which I really loved.
Yeah, because what I understand and what I'm sort of trying to build towards is you've had a lot of experience throughout your career and you've raced in all types of levels. You've also got a master's degree in professional riding. You've written a book, Domestique, with your ex-teammate, Charlie Wigelius, or former pro teammate. And you've raced, like I said, all these different styles of team. Drapac Porsche was very amateur. And then, you know, like you just said about, you know, Bike Hut was also a very different setup. Rafa Condor, another setup. You've been, at Barlow World, and maybe you didn't know it. It was just like almost the perfect sort of building blocks to where you are now as a director. And that's what I see as a director sportif, someone who runs a team who has a whole wealth of knowledge of different scenarios. You're not just like pigeonholed in a World Tour team from day one to day dot. you've got to experience everyone's level. And I see you as a really experienced director who understands all those levels. And just when I looked at your career and I was like, huh, that's why. Do you sort of see that as a work in progress to where you are now, and without even knowing that's how it was, and you were just sort of searching for what, you know, what you really wanted and what made you happy?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I think it was Adam Hansen the other day on the podcast. It's basically like, you're never the finished article as a writer. And I don't think you're ever the finished article as a sports director either. I think I'm still evolving. But sort of like going back, I never thought I'd be a sports director. So it was never with the intention of doing it. But I mean, I started racing. After I finished my GCSEs, so exams you do at 16, so the VCE for you, basically. Like I went to Holland for 3 months to go and race for a Dutch team when I was 16 years old. All I wanted to do was race. And I did it like in a lot of different places, a lot of different countries. I mean, I was amateur in France for 2 years, in Holland and Belgium for 1 year. And like all of those elements kind of taught me something. And it's only now that like I am where I am that I look back and kind of, I mean, try and take the things that I did learn. I mean, the first thing I did when I got a job as a sports director was just write a list of who was a good sports director I had and who was a bad one, and what the things were that I liked or didn't like about them. And then that's when I saw the sort of like what you're talking about, this different patchwork of all these people and influences that you kind of go, okay, well, I can take from this and that. And
well, let me run through that little transition there quickly, because after 2011, you decided to call it a day and you ended up working for Rafa. From what I understand, because we were met over in Tour of Britain at that point, and I always remember this, you're like, look, I'm just sort of doing some stuff with some press officer, or I'm not too sure what I'm going to do. And that's sort of, from what I could see from the outside, you can tell the story better than I, it evolved into being a sports director at Rafa, sort of getting your feet a little bit wet there, where you then went to, you know, Drapac, back to Drapac in Australia, and went full-time as a sports director, and that team there was building up. Their idea was to go across and race in Europe, and I think as a sports director, it was actually a perfect sort of fit. It wasn't huge, but it was a nice next step, and people were willing to give you confidence, and you were able to make decisions where they weren't like World Tour big decisions, but they still had a bit of weight. And then finally, Drapac merged with Cannondale. You came across with that merger, and that's where you are now. Run me through a little bit of that sort of transition from being a pro or finishing cycling to becoming a sports director, which you said wasn't something you thought. It sort of just happened, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, like, firstly, I would say I think I was super lucky with, with John Herity, because I think that in his own way, John gave me the space, because the first year I came to Rafa, I raced quite hard. The second year I had a crash and I broke my elbow and I was out for a long time. And that's when I started studying my masters. And John gave me a lot of space to kind of like, once it became obvious I wasn't going to race any longer, to sort of take up a role in the team. He always wanted me to be to sort of do a bit more sort of sports directing. And I didn't want to do it. So I said, no, I'll be the press officer. And he's like, okay. And I mean, Rafa Kondo had a press officer, and I mean, it was a Conti team, like, who does that? But he did, and then I did some races. And
What did you actually do?
I don't even know, man. I just wrote some wrote some race reports, and you know, but it was really good. And yeah. Eventually, he twisted my arm and sent me off to Korea to go and do a race in Korea, and we ended up my first race winning the Tour of Korea overall. And it was quite cool. We finished with two riders, right? And my only regret was that one of the riders, I asked him to abandon on the last stage, like maybe a kilometer to go or something, like when it was safe. So then we could say we had 100% record. We finished the race with one rider. I think we just lost a rider every day, because I just got the guys so G'd up to race that like every day they were just exhausted. I mean, they were 19, 20-year-old kids. But then we had like a really nice, like a good team. John had done all the work in the background, and he was sending me off to races with Tim Kenyak, who was with us the last couple of years now with Bahrain. James Griffin, who was with the team with us for a while. Rob Palmer, like really good guys. And we had a nice thing going, and we were going over to these races in Japan and Korea and stuff. And it was really successful. We won the next year Tour of Korea again with Hugh Carthy, who was 19 at the time. Three stage wins, and like from there I just kind of like got a bit more confidence. We got an invite to the Tour of Colorado or US Pro Challenge, and that's where I ran into the Drapac guys, Darren Lapthorne, who's, you know, a mutual friend of both of ours, and he said that there was, you know, potentially an opportunity with Drapac to be a full time sort of sports director, and it kind of it just led as to me it was like the next step, and I was really fortunate that I got that opportunity to go there, like you said, and make kind of the mistakes you have to make before being at the highest level. Because, I mean, without a background as, you know, a world tour, like a top world tour pro, it's hard to have that credibility. You have to just learn the steps on the way up. And, I mean, I look back now at myself when I started at Drapac and some of the, you know, some of the decisions you made, some of the things you did, and you're just like, man, what were you doing? But it was really good for me. It taught me a lot, and it taught me what I could and couldn't do and shouldn't be doing. And as soon as I got there, like, it was obvious they were ambitious. Like, Michael was at the time, Michael Drapac was super ambitious, and he really, really wanted to, you know, get there. And the year we went to Europe, I was really into like this vision of just growing into like a legitimate pro Conti team, because, you know, it's one thing to get the pro Conti license. It's another thing to be that, like, legitimate, you know, you turn, you look and you go, you know, like, Wanty, they're a legitimate pro Conti team, and they get the invites. And it's a tough place to be, because the politics of the sport and getting into races and coming from outside of Europe and stuff. And I think, you know, Michael made the decision and it all went together with Canada, which brought me here, but brought me here at the right time of my sort of career.
Yeah, it was the natural next step. You, like you said, you were learning your ropes, and I'm not going to say you were comfortable, but like, the next step to keep growing was, all right, let's go for the big league. All right, well, great. I'm glad that sort of filled the gap for everyone out there to understand a little bit what a sports director is, and we might refer to it as DS throughout this now, or director sportif, sorry. I've got a whole bunch of questions. This is actually a slash mailbag today. So we've got some questions. Everyone sent their questions in. There's some cracking ones there. And I just thought I would start with my own question at the top of the mailbag, just to give everyone a bit more of a format of what you do. We pretty much know what a day-to-day life is as a writer. But something I always find interesting is we think we know what a sports director does, like, as writers. And I always love talking to you, and especially writers who just transfer across, you know, and they come back and go, oh, you guys have got no idea what we have to do now. On that light, run me through briefly a day in the life of a sports director. You know, let's just run me through what a typical day is, race day.
Yeah, I mean, so firstly, before we go to the race, we do a lot of homework. Like, there's a lot of work done at home to make our lives a little bit easier on the race, because once you're in the race and things are moving, it's exhausting. So before anything, I try and get a good night's sleep. That makes a huge difference. It's kind of the old idea of, like, the sports directors sit in the bar and drink beers and whatever, but, like, you just can't really do it anymore because the job's pretty intense. So get some sleep and then get up early, and then the first thing is generally double-checking the wind. Is what we've thought right? Is this going to be, you know, the way things are going to go today? And then, you know, then you can go to breakfast and think about whether or not anything has to change. We normally have a few sports directors at a race, and we generally tend to meet after breakfast. So might, you know, if it's nice weather, might go for a walk for 10 minutes and discuss the day and make sure, like, we all agree on the plan of the day, or, you know, sit at the table or whatever, or go to someone's room and go through the day. And then basically, probably I would say at some point, just double check the race manual to make sure that there's no mistakes in the start time, which is just like, you know, yeah, that high school, the dream you have at school of forgetting to put your pants on or whatever. Check the traffic on the way to the start of the race, make sure there's no road closures. And then basically head to the, you know, get down to the bus. And then we might have another meeting to go through the actual presentation for the day, whichever one of us is going to do. So all the rest of the sports directors are really clear on the slides that are going to be seen and that kind of thing.
Just to pause you there, this is something, and I know you would know this for sure, because I've seen the change in my career, but you were racing before I started racing. This is something that's evolved heavily over my career. the presentation. I love how you refer to it as a presentation. Used to be the brief, or, you know, maybe open up your book if you had time. Now it's like a full-on thing. And like you just mentioned then, there's a pre-meeting to make sure the presentation for the writers is correct.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's like you can get quite... You can go too far with it, and you can spend too much time working on a nice PowerPoint when, you know, sometimes like the most effective message is really simple.
Like 50 minimum, like you want to try and keep it under 50, 60 slides, don't you?
Yeah, you know, just like under 45 to 48 minutes, you know. No, I mean, you need to keep it simple, but it generally is clear at least, because we've also got guys with different languages, right? So, and then, you know, like once we get to the race, we do the meeting, get that message across. In that moment, we just need to make sure that everybody gets off the bus knowing with a clear idea what's going to happen, you know, or what the plan is and what they do for the day. Maybe you have to have an extra word with someone or just to make sure it's really clear, but generally you try and avoid, you know, running around between individuals, adding little extra bits of this and that, because then you're just confusing the message. So once that's done, then it's kind of like this odd, you've got an hour to wait for the start and get your car ready and go and chat some sort of BS with the mechanic or whatever.
Have you got like a typical thing now? Because that sounds like it's limbo land. And there would have been, for me, I'm just imagining I'd go, you know what? I need to find something to do in this limbo time. Have you got something that you do?
It's the worst. You know, like sometimes you go outside and you have that minute when you're like, lean back on the bonnet. Like, ah, nah, not comfortable here. Not going to stand here. I'll go and lean against the bus. Ah, nah, not going to be here. Because all the riders are getting changed in the bus and like the music's on and you're trying to keep everybody out of there. Nobody wants you there sort of messing around with a coffee machine, you know? And so you just sort of kind of fold your arms and stand around or go and sit in the car. It's a horrible... I hate that time, man.
Because I can imagine it's one of those situations where you can't just go, you know what, I'm just going to like do something constructive, but it looks like then you don't care. So you got to do absolutely like this half sort of limbo land.
Yeah. Or on the flip side, you know, like you could just go to a cafe where you can see the bus and if anybody needs you, they can grab you and you could sit down, but then everyone's going to be like, what the hell's RDS doing? He's just like sat over there having an affogato. Like, what the hell? And then obviously like once the race gets going, that's 4 or 5 hours. And honestly, I mean, when you get out of the car at the end of that, you are toasted. It's exhausting mentally. It really is draining. And then immediately after the race, we debrief with everyone, try and get that finished as quickly as possible, what we have to get through, you know, any difficult things, anything that's come up. So we can get back to the hotel and everything's sort of finished and the guys can have dinner together in a calm way and be, you know, be a team again. I sort of try not to go into the riders' rooms too much after the race because they don't necessarily want to be thinking about the race. So then, you know, if you go and check on the staff, the mechanics, any problems with the bikes, bits and pieces, and then start doing it all again. So it's, you know, they're busy days. I mean, when I get back from a grand tour, I basically every time I sit down I fall asleep, you know. You get home and like even though you haven't turned a pedal or whatever, I get on the couch and just basically fall asleep. It's tiring.
I think that's one thing that's definitely underestimated is as a rider you have busy days as well, but there's periods where you get to switch off. But for you guys, those times that you switch off, they're sort of like we said, they're limbo land. So you're not really switching off. You're like waiting outside of a bus or, you know, whatever, driving a car back to the hotel. So you don't really ever get that time to yourself. So it is taxing in a different kind of way.
Shoot à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, of course, the man who the sports directors hear relaying those messages throughout the race, and he's interrupting Mitch Docker's conversation with Tom Southam to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Beer 52. Now, if you're in the UK, you can get a free case of 8 craft beers sourced and curated from some of the best breweries on the planet delivered to your door for just the cost of postage, which is £5.95. Go to beer52.com/cycle Each case is delivered to your doorstep, so you don't need to leave the house. If you're looking to stock up on a few beers for the summer, then join the club. Beer 52 is the world's most popular craft beer discovery club. There are over 150,000 members, and each month, each member gets a brand new case of beers to discover, and there's a different theme each month. If dark beer is not your thing, you can simply choose lighter options and your case will come with an award-winning beer magazine, Ferment, and a tasty snack. Now, in my case this month, I got a bottle of Mosaic IPA by Black's Brewery, who are in Cork in Ireland. And although it's a darkish beer, it goes very well with these warm temperatures at the moment because it's light, it's fresh, it's slightly fruity. There's a hint of citrus in there, and it really goes very well with sitting down to listen to a podcast as the sun goes down. So if you would like to sample what Beer 52 has to offer and perhaps join the club, go to beer52.com/cycle to get your first case of 8 beers for just £5.95. That's beer52.com/cycle. Now let's get back to Mitch's conversation with Tom Southern. Cheers.
Let's crack into these questions. Mine was a bit of a long one, but thanks, Tom. That sets it up. Look, I think Rory's first off the bat today. He's more or less asked a question, moving from competitive cycling, competitive racing to DS, what does that look like? I think we've more or less covered that.
I mean, no, there's one thing I would add to that, is that basically, you know, like when you get into your bed at night in a race, your body's exhausted, right? It's knackered and you've done your job and your mind's empty. When you transition to a DS, you get into bed at night and your body's done nothing, but your mind is exhausted, like fried. And so the transition between being a racer and being a DS is like the really hard thing. And I know like there's strong rumors that our new DS was falling asleep in the car at the not while driving, while he was doing his trials last year at the Vuelta. So it's just the switch from your physical exhaustion to mental fatigue.
Well, on the back of that, what physical exercise can you do? Because it sounds like I've always imagined this year, I just go running and, you know, do this, do that. It sounds like it's pretty hard to fit that in.
Yeah, I mean, there's a small window sort of generally. I mean, some guys get up super early and go and do stuff. I don't like to do that, just get out of bed at 5 and go. But there's a small window sort of when you get back. If there's somebody else there who's like, let's go for a run, which is like at the Tour de Andreas is always like, right, let's go. Then we just go and we run 5Ks or something just for the little bit of mental space. And you run slowly and it doesn't actually matter or whatever. It's just about clearing your head a bit.
All right. How does it differ being a DS for the Classics versus a Grand Tour? That one, sorry, is from Wespa.
So I think in terms of the actual job in the car, like when you do the classics, like I do the Ardennes, so I do Amstel Flesh Liège. So you get gaps between, and we stay in one hotel. And so it's like focus, race, and then recover basically. Whereas the hard thing at a Grand Tour is all the moving, you know, because when you finish a stage, you might have 2 hours in the bus or 3 hours in the bus where you're not recovering or you can't really work, you know. You try and look at your laptop in the back of a moving bus in, you know, July in the middle of France, going down a mountainside. You're not doing anything. So you lose a lot of time in Grand Tours just moving from A to B. And I think that's is the build-up fatigue of just losing time constantly that makes the Grand Tours.
Does that mean the setup before a Grand Tour is larger? I'm not saying that you don't do as much work for a classic. It is one day, so it's different again. But what I'm imagining there is preparing for a Grand Tour is huge because you're like, I more or less have to have this thing ready to roll 21 stages when I get there. And all I'm doing is fine-tuning a little bit each night.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be looking at, you know, the race route apart from just refreshing yourself midway through a Grand Tour. You want to know it and have done the work already. Whereas a classic, you can have all that. You've got it right there, you know. Also, a Grand Tour changes a lot more. So, I mean, Amstel Gold Race, apart from a few minor changes to the final, you know, like is going to be like last year in terms of the route, and you double check and you make sure there's no big differences. You know, Liège, there's a few minor tweaks. Flesch changes a bit more often, but the finish circuit's the same. Whereas a Grand Tour, you've got a lot of homework to do.
You just practically opening up the race manual, like, all right, stage six done. Now, where are we for stage seven? Let's have a look at this thing. 10 o'clock at night. Here we go.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Giro d'Italia. Right.
All right. Kenny, what is the worst part of the job when working on a stage race?
It's just, again, it's the physical toll of sitting in a car for 6 hours trying to do your job. Like, because the more stressed you get, I think the more you sort of tend to scrunch up. And sort of like the first time I did the Grand Tour, like at the end of it, I was just a hunched up person because I was just like bent over a steering wheel with my knuckles sort of going white from stress and tension. And it has a real physical toll. And so I find looking after yourself is hard.
This is a two-part question. What is more useful as a director, being psychologically well-tuned or having ridden, say, 15 grand tours? So, yeah, understanding the psychology of the riders or actually having experience from riding. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for having done 15 grand tours, but I mean, it depends what you take from it, doesn't it? I think being psychologically well attuned to the riders has more value than having... you could get that from doing 15 grand tours because you might be a smart bloke who works those things out. But just that on its own isn't really... It's such a small component of the job because as well as the riders, there's the staff, right? So you might be able to communicate with a rider about a climb or a part of the race, but you also have 25, 28 people who you have to manage. And not knowing how to do that can be quite taxing. So
I guess also the biggest part there I was thinking about is 15 grand tours in your time and 15 grand tours now are completely different things. And you've got to continually evolve. I think even thinking about a guy like Andreas Klier, the way he raced the classics, he's an amazing director in the classics, but he's evolved to the way we race now. He understands it and he learns it. And that experience he had from racing, yes, it helps him, but I think it's getting less and less and less. And he's just got more experience from understanding what the racing is now. And like you said, managing the riders, managing the staff and psychologically understanding what is needed. I think that's the biggest element. And to a degree, if you can say you're somewhat of an amateur rider DS, not coming from 15 grand tours, but you still make a really good DS, that's your proof of the pudding is that it's not all about how many races you've done or what races or how many races you won. It's the old saying, like the best, you know, in a junior team, the best player is the captain. That's not true because you've got to learn from all those experiences, I would think anyway.
100% agree. I think, yeah.
All right, next one. Koaza is saying this question. I've read that completely wrong. How does a tour team structure their workload each day?
So, I mean, from a DS part, from what we do, if I give you an example, at the tour we have three DSs. So one of us basically takes responsibility for all of the logistics, which vehicles are going where, who's going to stand on what mountain with bottles and wheels, and which soigneur is going to be at the finish, whether we're going to park the bus at the bottom of the climb or at the top of the climb, if we've got any sort of changes, how far it's going to be to the hotel, who's going to go to the hotel, and managing all that sort of staff and logistics side. So that's one job in itself. And that person then also drives the second car, which, you know, covers breakaways or the gruppetto, depending on what's happening. And then you have another DS who can do avant course, so going in front of the race by 20 minutes and reporting back sort of live weather conditions as they go. And then obviously another DS in what we call, you know, car one, which is the sort of brains of the tactical operation of the race, and they all support each other. That's how we sort of spread the work as DSs.
David, how do you as a DS or road captain deal with inter-team rivalries? Are there any big rivalries in particular?
Good one. I mean, from my side, like, we're trying to use every other team to do the work for us, and so is everybody else. And I think, you know, from time to time you see things in one race, there might be two teams that are close fighting for the same thing. And it feels like there's a bit of a rivalry. But I mean, maybe that's one more for you, Rich, you know.
I guess I try and take the psychological tact, whether that is verbal and not get into the front on verbal fight. But you can just sort of sometimes, whether it's, you know, a simple thing like, hey, you boys look pretty strong there, or something like that. You guys going to put, I saw you guys put one up there, it's just sort of that, if there's that rivalry there, you got to sort of start playing the head games if you can, without it getting sort of personal and things kicking off, you're just trying to find out what they're up to and you're just trying to play it sort of smart if you can without it turning into a big biffo. That's the tact I would sort of go for.
So you're basically the Australian wicketkeeper of the situation, Mitch.
I was an ex-wicketkeeper, so yeah.
Perfect.
Exactly that, you're just there, letting you know that we're here and we're pretty good too. Well, the Pocket Egg sent in a question. Any advice for amateur racers looking to provide DS-like support to teammates without a radio?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. I mean, radio or no radio, the game is always the same. You work out the demands of the race. You work out who you have in your team. You make a plan between you and your guys, and you agree on the best way to win the race. And then you make the guys that are racing accountable for that happening. And, I think in a really, really good, highly functioning team, you almost don't have to say a word. Like after you've said, this is how we're doing it, the rest everyone should understand what's going on. And that doesn't, you don't need the radio to do that. What you need is a clear idea, a belief in how you can do it. And that's, anybody can have that at any level, really. And the right chemistry with the team. And then if you want to be the DS, you have to be the person who sort of says, all right, lads, this is the way we're going, and get everybody to jump on board with that. And then if you do that, that's it.
Yeah, exactly. And you deal with the consequences afterwards in terms of someone needs to make the plan. We all need to get on board. And 9 times out of 10, that plan will work because you've made a concrete decision. Let's go that way. And, those other times it doesn't, you go, cool, let's assess what happens. And rather than being, there's nothing worse than having that wishy-washy plan. I think that could happen. Maybe we'll try that, maybe that. And then next thing you know, nothing happens. Yeah, I think that's good. Next one. This is from Glenn. How do you decide who is best to support a GC rider?
This all comes down to the sort of the variables of the race course, the demands of the race, how sort of well-positioned our GC rider would be in terms of whether or not we expect to have to pull for them at any point. You might have a tour when, it's going to be crosswindy for the first sort of 4 or 5 days. Okay, we need guys for the crosswind. How many guys do we need? Who's good at that? Who's in the right shape? And basically sort of getting, there's different types of riders and we just have to work out who's going to fill those positions and how many of which one you need, and that's all based on the course and who the GC rider is. There's a lot that goes into that. It's actually a big old question.
Nice. Pom de Terra. To us watching the TV, at times it looks like multitasking mayhem in the DS car. How do you do it?
I mean, that's one. Yeah, it's basically like trying to watch the TV and listen to the radio and listen to a record at the same time. There's a lot of information coming in, and what you have to do is just focus on what the most important information is. I mean, there's also all the stuff of the convoy and the cars flying around. That becomes second nature the more you do it. And you realize as soon as you're driving a convoy that everybody's on the same page. Driving is less chaotic than you think, because every driver's sort of following the same path. Nobody wants to get in the way of a rider. Everybody's doing the same job. So generally that's kind of takes care of itself. And then it's just basically processing the information that's hard. So if race radio is talking, for example, we get it when a brake will go and race radio, there's a delay, and then they'll start telling me in the car which numbers there are. And a rider might start talking on the radio. It's when you have to the guys have to shut up because we miss the numbers. And then we don't know who's in the brake and who the right guy is. And that can be a really frustrating moment. So sometimes you have to preempt that and say, guys, no talking until we give you the numbers. And just trying to keep things really clear. And generally in the car, when those moments happen, the mechanic's good in the back. They're listening to the radio as well. They're helping. And most guys get it, you know. I think we had a couple of incidences this January where there were people having conversations when we were waiting for race numbers. But, yeah.
It does happen. Like, and as riders too, like on the flip side, it's just like when too many riders talk, it can get quite annoying. And also, I often find, I don't know what it is, but it must get boring when we're on a climb because obviously the pace slows down, it's less hectic, there's no riders back there, whatever. So I get the feeling it's a great time for DSs just to relay like some useless knowledge or some knowledge that you just don't need at like threshold on a climb. But you often get that in. It's like, by the way, boys, just looking at that finishing circuit. Now, there is three corners there. Two of those corners are 90, and you just like, either tell me how many K to go and the percentage on this climb or shut up. Yeah, because you're at a threshold. So it's quite funny. The radio is quite a funny thing. I've always wondered, is it hard to understand the different riders?
I mean, I reckon you get 50% of the time you get what people are actually saying. Because, I mean, firstly, some guys just aren't clear. Secondly, you know, as soon as it's a cold day and guys have got 3-4 jackets on, it gets really muffled. People generally tend to speak when they're panicking. They don't talk in a calm voice. And there's only so many times you want to say, I did not copy that, because everybody else is getting pissed off. And some guys are better than others. I think it was, what was it, Harvelson this year when we started with him, I just like couldn't understand a word he was saying. But by the end of sort of a month together racing, he was quite clear. But it can be really hard. And also knowing who's who. So something, it sounds so childish and simple, but someone will say, front wheel puncture. And it's like, okay, who is it? People are riding different wheels. Some guys are on 40s, some guys are on 55s, and we need to know.
What's your go-to? It's just not a punch or anything, but like someone's saying something and you've like three times, sorry, didn't catch that. And they said it again, didn't catch it. What's your go-to response?
Time gap. Time gap. It's 1 minute 30, five riders. Because you know after that, that if it's serious, they're going to come back. So you just drop a time gap in there and generally shuts them up.
I think I had some directors too, used to just do eat and drink. You're like, so how far is it to the top of this climb? And you're like, you're starting to panic because you really want to know the top of the climb. And you'll hear like, yep, 3 minutes to the front. You're like, God damn it, I didn't want to know that. They're all like, that's right to remember, boys, just eat and drink over the, you know. You're like, no, I know that. I can actually feel my own body's needs.
Yeah.
Oh, God. All right, what else have we got here? Aldi, what are some of the unspoken rules of the peloton that fans might not know about? Look, there is the simple piss. I think most people know about that. It's sort of an unspoken rule that once the break forms, there's almost like a truce and everyone wants the break to go because everyone wants that pause in the race. So, you know, you might try and create a piss if that's beneficial to you. And the unspoken rule is that once we all sort of the break goes, might even have 20 seconds, it's clear that it's done. We all stop and have a piss, whether you need to or not. It's sort of like a pause in the race, reset. Okay, break's got some time, a team will control. But what often happens now, more often than not, is people see it as an opportunity to just try and start things up again. And that is like, if you're already feeling tired, that's hell on earth because you're just like, uh-oh, here we go. And it's quite a cool thing if you're the guy who started the piss, that you've got that kind of presence. You're like, yeah, you're the first guy to take the risk of unclipping because it's quite risky. Just say you take the piss and it hasn't gone, then you've taken your foot out and the bunch doesn't stop. Next thing you know, you're in the cars, you're chasing. And you're like, yeah, well, that didn't work. But if you're the guy that stops and everyone goes, yeah, actually, well, if Mitch is stopping, now I'm just going to stop too. You're like, yeah, that's right, boys. I control this bunch.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's waiting for that guy, aren't they? It's like, okay, when's this first guy going to stop?
Well, often it's the yellow jersey or the leader of the race. But I've seen it happen where his presence still doesn't have enough presence and the race goes on. Probably more so back when you were racing, that was more done respectfully, I would think, than now.
Yeah, but it actually got stupid at one point. I remember doing a race in Germany where one of the Gerolsteiner guys who had the yellow jersey, like 30K to go, called a pissot just because there were too many attacks. And you're like, man, it's 30K to go, the race is on. And like yelling at people and screaming is like, all right.
I can't think. What are some other unspoken... Well, there's like the whole line of where you sit in the bunch. Like, you know, leaders team gets to sit... If they're leading the race, they're obviously working, so they sit first. But then often what happens is if the leading team is not working and another team, for instance, it's a sprint stage and the leading team's got a team of climbers, so they're not interested in the sprint stage, a sprinter's team will be riding, so their whole team will be lined up first behind. And the unspoken rule is the leading team then gets second position. And then so on and so forth. If there's another team working, they get first and second. And it's sort of unspoken, whatever team first started riding, just for instance, there's three teams working together on the front. The first team that started riding gets first position, second team riding, second and third. And that can be a bit wishy-washy sometimes. I know that for a fact because we use that tactic in the Worlds this year with Australia. Oh, last year was in Yorkshire. It was a horrible day. And we were like, we're going to ride anyway. Let's be the first team to ride so we can be first sitting there. And it was a great tactic because we were first there. We rode probably like 5 or 10K before any other team were thinking about riding. The break had only just gone and we just went straight there with Rowan Dennis. We let the break roll out, but we were first team there, which meant we were first sitting there. And yeah, another team could have tried to take it off us, but that's sort of the unspoken rule. And that was quite a good little tactic.
That's a nice move. I mean, the unspoken rules are always for the slow bits. You know, it all goes out the window, I guess. Yeah, I mean, there's a few unspoken rules back in the cars, but Aja Dessert seemed to just ignore all of those and drive past everyone anyway.
All right, well, let's move on. If you could change one thing about the current race culture dynamic, what would it be, Harrison?
I mean, it would never happen, but like I would love it if riders couldn't get to their mobile phones until they got to the hotel. Because I feel a lot like there's not enough engagement with the race after the race because everybody hops on, headphones on, start looking at pictures of themselves or call their wife or whatever, which is fine. Obviously, you need to communicate with your loved ones and that's great. But sometimes I think it can take away from like an honest discussion on the bus about the race or just more conversation about the race. So people are learning, you know, if a young guy's there and he's listening to other people talk about what happens on the race, you know, so instead of putting your headphones on, you're talking about what's happened in the race, two guys, and then there's one young guy sat behind. He's learning just by listening. I feel like obviously everyone's knackered. People just want to get on their phones and just leave everything behind. But our team's really good. Guys aren't on the phone at dinner time. You know, we don't have one, you know, that's really nice. But that's more sort of general kind of chit chat and stuff. Sometimes it's good to have, you know, I mean, it's your job. It is a big focus in your life and it would be a good thing to have a bit more sort of to and fro and not stimulated by DS saying, hey guys, tell me about this or...
I think also on that note, like maybe you weren't really getting to this point of it, but I think also your opinion gets warped then from... what you read opposed to what you feel and what your teammates say. So like you were just saying then, yeah, you're distracted by you're on your phone or on your headphones on, so you're not listening to your teammates, but also you're reading or watching or looking at what happened in the race and forming your opinion from that article or whatever, or that paper result or whatever instantly. And so you never get to put your emotion from that day out. Like you said, you're listening to your teammates and you've got this emotional story, but suddenly you're in your own little world. And then your opinion changes from this outside source. And I think that's another point I would say is one thing I don't really love is everything is a little bit too much dictated by power, SRMs, Garmins. You know, like, you know, even I look, I'm very guilty of this. You justify your day on how hard it was from how much power you used, opposed to trying to save energy. Now you're sort of searching to have a hard day, if that makes sense. You know, like, because then you can justify whatever you did because you had this TSS or this hard day. It actually could be looked at, you're actually a bit stupid. You rode in the wind too much. You did this, you did that, because you shouldn't have had that harder day. You know, whereas it's actually getting promoted that
you know, I had a 400 TSS. Oh, well done. You know, it's like, well, you shouldn't have had that. You should actually be trying to search to have the lowest TSS in a stage because you're saving energy, you're smart. You know, if that can also get warped another way because then you're a soft cock. But you know what I'm trying to say. Like, I think there's too much hanging on that factor opposed to just the smartest guy wins the race or the smartest, strongest guy wins the race. Now it's just who can just be the strong bastard, you know. There's that element of it now, and that goes back to guys, you know, the way guys are getting signed now. They're not necessarily racers. They're just strong guys, and we'll teach them how to race later. So there is that culture that I think is slightly changing a bit now, but definitely very present in the peloton at the moment. This is from Kevin. What is your favorite post-Grand Tour meal? Do you know any superstitious riders out there? Well, I'll tackle this first one. Post-Grand Tour meal. Look, I guess it's probably hot here now. Maybe this is a bit warped, but I don't eat a lot of red meat on the race. I sort of bought into that more so on this team. I was aware of it in Greenedge that the body takes a lot more energy to digest it. And so I'm eating a lot more fish and chicken. And then when I come back, I really enjoy like a good barbecue. Just get the meat on there, few cold beers, good glass of wine. That's probably my comeback. And also there's signifiers just relaxing, being around in the backyard, having a barbie. So that's, you don't get to do that on a Grand Tour either. It's all buffets or eating in a restaurant or whatever. So just being outside, feeling very Aussie, I guess. What about superstitions? Like superstitious rides? I actually did hear this one story about Cipollini once. That he had to have, you probably know this, he had to have a fresh jar of jam every morning. And if anyone knows, when you open up like a jar of jam, it makes that first open from the seal makes that pop noise. Like, and he had to have that pop every morning. As soon as he'd had his jam from that, he'd just throw it away, fresh jar the next day. Is that true?
I mean, it sounds like a reasonable story, doesn't it? Why not? Super Mario, man. He did what he wants.
All right. Terry Steer, what do you guys do after a Grandy recovery-wise? Do you have any small recovery blocks? How long usually? And do you come back flying and are able to use that form jumping to the next level? I'll tackle this one. Mate, that's true. We call it the Grandy grind. By the end of a Grand Tour, you're sort of get so fatigued, but you get strong. And last year after, or 2 years ago after the Giro, I probably had my longest time off. I had 2 weeks completely off. I did 3 weeks training and I went to the Tour of Austria. It was the best form of my life. I was flying. And I was just like, what the hell's going on here? Because I actually let the body soak up that Grand Tour. That's a mistake I've made in the past. You think you're recovered and then you get back into it after a week, but actually it takes a long time. Everyone's different. To let that thing, and you know, to use a sponge as an analogy, to let it soak in. And then you've got this amazing sort of grind where you just like, you can hurt. And then all of a sudden you're like, ah, oh, maybe I will go across that break, bugger it. You click it down and just ride across. Now that's, not that happens all the time, but it's that feeling like you can sort of do anything. It's a pretty cool feeling. Like you go through hell and you come out the other side. It's something, you know, coming to the end of the last week, you're like, I'm going to do this for the form. Next one, Sir Noel. Is there a difference between indoor trainer FTP and outdoor FTP? I think, like, I should know this because my coach is like a swift man. I'm pretty sure it's about 7%. Yeah, you minus 7% on indoor trainer. Like, it's around something like that. Like, because, look, my FTP outside is 410. And so what's 7% of that? I guess it's like 30 watts maybe, something around that. So it's just something like that, less 30 watts. I'm pretty sure you'd probably be able to find a better answer than me.
I mean, I guess it depends on how like truthful you are with your weight on your indoor trainer thing, doesn't it? That's all I know.
That is a big one. And too, and I think it is relative too to do an FTP test, if you could be bothered, on the indoor trainer is probably the best way to do it. Luke, what is the best way for an under 19 to get to the pro peloton?
I mean, I think like at under 19 is still young. The best thing you can do is have a picture in your, like an idea in your head of as to where you want to get to understand the steps that you've got to take to get there, and then to focus on those little by little. So you're not trying to like eat the whole cake in one go and rush to being a pro or whatever. You know, you want to get to the pro peloton, and then you want to do things obviously in the pro peloton, not just get there. So what are the steps you have to make to get there? Who are the people around you that you can talk to understand what it entails? And then just try and, you know, one step at a time, make your way there. You know, unless you're a complete freak, you're not going to just leap there in one go. It's a long process, and you have to just keep your eyes on the prize without getting, you know, dissuaded by setbacks or whatever. I mean, yeah.
Let's move on to the next one. This is an interesting question given the time. This is from Sprockick. What do you think the impact of all the COVID Zwift racing will be on real life racing after this period?
I think that it's easy to confuse Zwift racing with just training on an erg. And this is something I've been thinking about, because a lot of people just see Zwift and then just assume automatically it's all about racing. But obviously you can use that platform to train as well. And it's not as simple as people just doing Zwift every day because they were locked inside. You had your sessions that you had to do on Zwift, as opposed to Mitch, you have to do a race in the morning and a race in the evening. So the actual races that have been happening, I think, will have very little effect on the racing in the future. It's not like races are going to start for 2 minutes, full gas, and then slow down, and then whoever's there. But what will make a difference is how seriously or not, and how well timed people have done their training through this period, which is a bigger question or subject than just the Zwift racing itself.
I do, and this is maybe slightly different to the answer to this question, but I just heard you say something that reminded me of it. I think I would like to see in the future these two platforms stay separate. And this is a conversation I've had recently with some other pros, is they're like, oh yeah, you know, like Zwift, and I was initially like this too. It's so different, you know, the drafting element's bullshit, you know, it's not like being on the road, and you know, you start, like you said, you start a race 2 minutes hard and it's not realistic. I said, well, I started understanding. I'm like, well, actually there's a e-pro and there's a road pro. They're two different things. So if you can master being a Zwift and you've done, you know, 1,000 hours on there and you can school a road pro, so be it. I shouldn't be able to just jump from the road and be able to win another platform. I think they should stay separate, and there should be a certain skill. Yes, we can both cross across and do okay, but you shouldn't just be able to come there and go, yeah, I just won Tour of Flanders on the road last week and I'm just going to win, you know, whatever, you know, Innsbruck Zwift race on Thursday morning, because that's a different skill. And I like that fact. I like that, you know, I got it handed to me there. Yeah, and I could keep up because I'm a pro on the road and I've got some physical attributes, but when it came to the sprint, I just got schooled. I couldn't win a Zwift race. So I sort of like that. And I think they should just keep them separate and not make it more realistic to road.
Yeah, I think yeah, they're separate things, aren't they?
All right, moving on. We've got a couple more. Now a few fun questions here. Well, not the others weren't, but this is just more different. This is from Josh. As a pro cyclist, you get to travel the world and race. Where have you raced that you would most likely go back and have a coffee ride? Look, hard to say go past Italy. And that's one of the things I do love about doing the Giro. Is I always found it so funny. I'm going to these places I always saw, like for instance, a bottle of San Pellegrino, and we're going up Mount San Pellegrino. I'm like, oh, this is where the water's from, you know? Or like you're in Parma and you just see these Parmesan cheese factories. You're like, wow, this is like, you know, it was just sort of like a Contiki cultural trip, you know? You just got to do some riding in between. So that's what I like about it. To put it down to one specific place, too hard.
It is a difficult one. I'd actually probably just go for Melbourne, honestly.
Mm.
You know, simple one, but, you know, there's good places to go, and it's a great place for riding and having a coffee.
This could be a quick one from Jordan. If you could ride for any pro team, past or present, who would it be?
I would go for Zed, circa 1990-1991, once Le Monde had arrived, because I think they were a pretty forward-thinking team. I mean, you look at their, like their jersey went from like the black and white of Peugeot to like this kind of way out there jersey, you know. And they just had Greg LeMond, and he had like different ideas, and, you know, Robert Miller and a few other people just like, and back in the day it was so, like teams didn't think differently, you know, like it was just super Eurocentric. So for them to break the mold like that would be cool.
I can't go past Mappe.
You know, like obviously for the aesthetics of it, the kit. But I love the idea of what Mappe were doing back then. You know, they had like 50 guys on their roster. And they were doing like, you know, the setup. They had their, you know, almost like a little amateur team coming through, a medium sort of pro team, and then their big team. It was just like this epic setup. And the guys that came out of that system, as we, you know, we know some of the best riders, you know, Fabian came out of there and the Aussie guys, Mick Rogers. You know, there's a million other guys, but it was looked like a cool outfit. I would have loved to have been on that team. Moving on, this is from Cabob. Music on training rides, yes or no?
For me, it used to be a definite yes, but now it's a no because I have a young family and I just want some peace and quiet when I go outside. So it's a no. I just like the time of quiet now.
I always have the headies in, actually. I'm listening to a lot of potties and actually I'm doing audiobooks at the moment. I've always got the headies in. I train alone a lot though. That's why.
Yeah, but like I tried audiobooks, but I can't hear them when I'm going down descents. So
you got that's true. I have to pause it or big headwinds. You just got to pause it. This is from Daniel. For better or worse, what major changes do you think we might see in the sport over the next decade or so?
I mean, the trend, the way things are going, like if I just see the margins between winning and losing getting smaller and smaller. And it sounds ridiculous, but if you go back to like the 90s and you watch the races, like, you know, riders were much further apart. Mm. And now everyone's getting better and faster and like equipment's playing much more of a role than ever, you know. And then you kind of get into this sort of Formula One territory where the guys who have the best equipment are going to be the best riders. And so I see that like the margins really narrowing between teams and riders.
This is from Gardetto. What's your favourite Melbourne pub?
I'm going to go for the Builder's Arms at the moment. Mm. Gertrude Street. I enjoy it down there. It's nice, good food, good little spot outside. And like, you know, from there you can always dip down to Smith Street or, you know, just go straight to Revolver, really, you know, if you need to.
From there. Yeah, just around the corner, other side of the city, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with, I've got a few up my sleeve. Look, I like the Union Hotel, which is down on Gore Street, just in Fitzroy there. Really classic, old sort of little round the corner pub vibe there. Good little rooftop. But I used to like going to this place called, I can't believe I forgot it. The John Curtin. John Curtin. It's on Lygon Street, just opposite RMIT, corner of Lygon Street and Victoria Street. And we used to sneak across there, like we get like little 10-minute breaks in our uni. Be like, all right, guys, 10 minutes, come back, go and have a smoke or whatever you want to do. And I'd be like, I had a couple of mates in there. We were like, should we get a quick jug at Curtin, at JC's? And of course, we never went back. So the old JC's, we used to hit that up. It was wasn't really a classic pub or anything, but it just served a purpose. And the last question here from Harry, best luft in the pillow. Who's got the best luft?
Historically, I reckon I'd go for Laurent Jalabert at his prime. That hat was just glued on his head.
I actually heard something, and I'm going to have to break this in talking luft as well. I don't know if you know anything about this. I think this is an amazing fact that I didn't know and should have known, that the boys back in the day used to spray their caps with hairspray.
No way.
To support luft and get rid of the collapse. And Zsa Zsa used to have it. Jalabert used to be able to keep that luft there. And I've always thought it was about the afro inside. And hence my favourite would be Miguel Indurain, because he was like racing the pointy end of the peloton, full speed, and that cap was just perfectly poised on his head. But it was down, I'm not sure if everyone did it, but the old hairspray, what a bloody tidbit of information that is.
It makes total sense now. I mean, why wouldn't you? Of course.
Apart from, I guess, if you start sweating in it.
The old hairspray in the eyes.
Yeah, that one.
On the tourmalet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Beautiful. All right. Well, guys, I hope we've answered all your questions there. We certainly got through a lot. Thanks, Tom, for doing that tonight. It was awesome. Cheers.
Cool. Good stuff. Cheers, man.
Well, there we have it. We couldn't get through all the questions, but we certainly had a crack at a fair few of them. And I tell you what, Southern, he's got a good way of answering those questions, I tell you. I had some answers in my head, but he had a really different perspective. And I love the way he projects the life of a director sportif. Some things I just didn't even know. What do you think about it, Lionel?
Well, I've known Tom quite a long time, both as a rider and more recently as a sports director. And what really stood out to me was when he was talking about the transition from racing into the job as a sports director, being around the team bus and the team hotel, and most particularly in the team car, often driving the team car, and the difference between the physical stress of racing and then taking it full circle, really, and having the mental stress of being the sports director, having to retain all of that information. You're managing, not, as he made the point, not just the riders in the team, but all of the staff as well, having to be across all of the details, making sure that logistically everything's running smoothly, and really not just giving the riders kind of direction, but also being a bit of a buffer so that any of the kind of stresses and strains of traveling around a country on a grand tour, really the riders are insulated from that. And what really stood out was that sensitivity that he had after the team meeting on the bus. He wants to get off the bus and get out of the way, let the riders get their kitted up finally and ready to go to the start line. And then he's got a sort of weird hour of downtime where, and the sense I got from his description of it was that just not being entirely comfortable, knows he can't go over the road to the cafe and be seen having a coffee while the riders are getting ready for the race, but perching on the team car bonnet, not feeling comfortable, not really knowing what to do with himself because everything hinges on the 4 hours in the team car and having that mental focus and mental energy. And I found that really interesting because those hours for the sports directors, they're when the likes of me and my colleagues, the other journalists, are approaching to sort of ask them how the race is going and, you know, who's doing what. Anyone in the team, you know, suffering after a crash, or everyone okay, you know, sort of asking questions that perhaps they don't really want to give too much away. And it was just interesting just to get an insight into his mindset during the period of time where I might have some interaction with him at the races. So I found that really interesting.
It is a weird dynamic because at the end of the day, one thing I've really noticed with especially friends or even ex-teammates that become directors, there's also this weird dynamic of suddenly I'm got to tell you what to do. And exactly what you said, that's a sort of a weird feeling. Tom and I have sort of found a really, I'm going to speak from my side of things, a really happy medium where we've still been able to retain that friendship as he's my superior, my boss. And there's also these other dynamics, and I love talking to a director, especially on the podcast, or even if I get a chance to pull them aside and just ask about that life that I sort of think I know about, but I don't really know about until I speak to them about it. And again, in this podcast, he was opening up some doors. I was like, oh, yeah, right. I didn't even realize that. So it was super interesting, and especially in this time as we're sort of looking towards racing again, I'm back out on the road, I'm training, and I'm starting to feel the itch. The fire is starting to go again. Racing's not far away, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, what is the schedule now? I mean, we're just right at the start of June. Racing should be back, we hope, at the end of July, it looks like. What do you have any sort of firm goals that you can actually fix on and work towards now?
Well, the first goal was I wrote it up today, straight down on a piece of paper, fat check I wrote. It's going to be a piece of paper above my scales. I haven't jumped on the scales this whole time, and I'm like, it's time. Oh, it's time. I've got to get on those scales, and I've got to start writing those weights down. I've got to see where I'm at. I've got to see the damage, and it's time to get in the lockdown. But apart from that, I actually want to do it. You know, up until sort of like a week or so ago, I couldn't see the racing. And when I couldn't see the goalposts, I couldn't see the finish line. It was so hard to set these goals. But now I can sort of see it. It's a couple of months away. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do, but I've just set my own goals. I'm like, in 2 months' time, I'm racing. I don't know what it's going to be, but I've got to be at race weight, and it's time to lock it down. I've got to take it from 12 beers a day, maybe down to like 6, and then slowly pull it back from there. But you know what? It's on. Tomorrow is the first weigh-in. Yeah.
Well, okay. So are you able to tell me what your race weight is? Can I put you on the spot and say what would be a good result when you get on the scales?
All right. It's out. Here we go. It's going to be out there in the world. All right. So I want to race at 74.5. if I'm at 75, I'm racing okay, but super lean's like 74 and a half. Anything under 75 is good for me. That's my, in my mind, it's like, if it says 74 something, I'm doing a good thing. I guess I'm tomorrow's the official weigh-in, but I'm guessing I'm somewhere like 77 something. I'm hoping it's not going to say 78 something, because then I've got a lot of work to do. But tomorrow's the real weigh-in. And, you know, I'm not going to put it up there, but you guys are going to feel my pain. It's on.
Well, I wish you luck. I mean, as long as the scales have been, you know, calibrated and, you know, they're on, an honest set of scales, that's all I can say.
It's going to be a hard slog, and pulling the wine and the beer out of it is going to be a big element of it. But it's what needs to be done. And I want to have a big end of the season. I think everyone's in that mindset that we've got 2 months of racing, and if we get it right, it's just 2 months full on, and it's going to be on. So I do want to say, you've got to listen to the Talking Luft in a week's time, because it is Tom Sutherland, and he has got an Ultimate Luft hat. I have never seen something like this. So make sure you hang in for Talking Luft in a week's time. I'm going to put a photo up of it. He's ridiculous. This is too much Luft. This is an example of too much Luft.
I'm getting in my head an image of like one of those baker's hats, you know, that stands right up completely tall.
it shits all over that. It's ridiculous. So
I'll look out for that. Have you got any idea what your episode of Life in the Peloton will be in a fortnight's time, or is that still a closely guarded secret?
I'm still working on it. I am looking at trying to get into the world of Strava, and that's something that's happened a little bit after Zwift. We're all engrossed in Zwift, and this Strava world's happening again now, because as pros, I mean, pros are going after Stravas now because we don't have racing. So Stravas are the next best thing. And I sort of want to get into that world of Strava. I still need to find the ultimate Strava hunter, as they're called. I'm not a hunter myself. I don't even have a Strava account. But I think it's a really interesting subject. So 2 weeks' time, I really want to talk to a hunter out there. You know, James Knox is one of those guys, or, you know, even George Bennett. They're taking the Stravas around where I am. So be interesting to talk to them, what drives them, and the whole world of Strava. I feel like it's a whole world I don't know. So that could potentially be, in 2 weeks' time, the podcast.
Excellent. Well, whether it's in 2 weeks' time or for a future episode, I'll look forward to that one.
Cheers, guys. And hang in there. Speak to you soon. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.